The earth, wrote Columbus, is shaped like a pear, of which one part is round, but the other, where the stalk comes, elongated. Or like a very round ball, on one part of which there is a protuberance, like a woman's nipple. The protuberance was to be found, Columbus believed, in the south, and on his third voyage, when his vessel sailed more rapidly northward than southward, he believed this showed that they had begun to go downhill. And he was the more convinced of his error, since some weeks earlier, at the southern reach of his voyage, when he had sailed between the island of Trinidad and the mainland of South America, the volume of fresh water pouring into the ocean from the mighty Orinoco, the roar as of thunder that occurred where the river met the sea, and the height of the waves which nearly wrecked his ships, had assured him that so great a volume of fresh water could have its origin only in one of the four rivers of paradise, and that he had at last, therefore, attained to the stalk end of the pear. Sailing north, he was leaving paradise behind. Columbus died without knowing that he had actually delivered the first of a series of blows that were presently to annihilate every image not only of an earthly, but even of a celestial paradise. In 1497, Vasco da Gama rounded South Africa, and in 1520, Magellan, South America. The torrid region and the seas were crossed, and no paradise found. In 1543, Copernicus published his exposition of the heliocentric universe, and some 60 years later, Galileo commenced his celestial researches with a telescope. And as we know, these researches led immediately to the condemnation of the new cosmology by the Holy Inquisition. Whereas you, Galileo, wrote the Holy Fathers, son of the late Vincenzo Galilei of Florence, aged 70 years, were denounced in 1615 to this holy office for holding as true a false doctrine taught by many, namely that the sun is immovable in the center of the world and that the earth moves and also with a diurnal motion, also for having pupils whom you instructed in the same opinions, also for maintaining a correspondence on the same with some German mathematicians, also for publishing certain letters on the sunspots in which you developed the same doctrine as true, also for answering the objections which were continually produced from the Holy Scriptures by glozing the said Scriptures according to your own meaning, and whereas thereupon was produced the copy of a writing in form of a letter professedly written by you to a person formerly your pupil in which, following the hypothesis of Copernicus, you include several propositions contrary to the true sense and authority of the Holy Scriptures. Therefore, this holy tribunal, being desirous of providing against the disorder and mischief which were thence proceeding and increasing to the detriment of the holy faith, by the desire of His Holiness and of the most eminent lords, cardinals of this supreme and universal Inquisition, the two propositions of the stability of the sun and the motion of the earth were qualified by the theological qualifiers as follows. 1. The proposition that the sun is in the center of the world and immovable from its place is absurd and philosophically false, and formally heretical, because it is expressly contrary to Holy Scriptures. 2. The proposition that the earth is not the center of the world, nor immovable, but that it moves and also with a diurnal action is also absurd, philosophically false, and theologically considered at least erroneous in faith. Therefore, invoking the most holy name of our Lord Jesus Christ and of His most glorious Virgin Mother Mary, we pronounce this our final sentence. We pronounce, judge, and declare that you, the said Galileo, have rendered yourself vehemently suspected by this holy office of heresy, that is, of having believed and held the doctrine, which is false and contrary to the holy and divine Scriptures, that the sun is the center of the world, and that it does not move from east to west, and that the earth does move and is not the center of the world. Also, that an opinion can be held and supported as probable after it has been declared and finally decreed contrary to the Holy Scripture, and, consequently, that you have incurred all the censures and penalties enjoined and promulgated in the sacred canons and other general and particular constituents against delinquents of this description. from which it is our pleasure that you be absolved, provided that with a sincere heart and unfeigned faith, in our presence, you abjure, curse, and detest the said errors and heresies, and every other error and heresy contrary to the Catholic and Apostolic Church of Rome. Three brief centuries later, and even the sun, which, in the words of Copernicus's English translator Thomas Diggs, like a king in the midst of all, reigneth and giveth laws of motion, to ye rest, has been dethroned. The great telescopes of America have shown the Milky Way system, of which our sun is but one member, to be a lens-shaped collection of some 100 billion stars, with our sun, a minor star, out toward the rim, its distance from the center of the galaxy being about 26,000 light-years, that is to say, a distance that light going at the rate of approximately 6,000 billion miles a year would require 26,000 years to traverse. Moreover, it has been found that our entire galaxy is spinning around its center at such a speed as would bring our sun through one full circuit in approximately 200 million years. Nor is our galaxy the only galaxy in existence. Photographic surveys of the skies made from the Mount Wilson Observatory in California have shown that galaxies tend to cluster in groups of over 1,000 in supergalaxies. Many supergalaxies have been identified, and this discovery has suggested to some the notion that our own galaxy may be an outrider in one such supergalaxy, such as the Sun that once was like a king in the midst of all, was presently found to be an outrider of the Milky Way. I shall not go on with this story, but simply ask, by way of introducing at this point one of the main questions of this subject, how in the way of reason is any mind confronted with this new image of the universe to understand, interpret, evaluate, or make any use whatsoever of the mythological cosmology of Holy Writ, or of any other of the many archaic traditions still asserting their superstitious claims in the modern world? Luther brayed at Copernicus, naming him an ass who wants to pervert the whole art of astronomy and deny what is said in the book of Joshua, only to make a show of ingenuity and attract attention. While His Holiness the Pope and the most eminent cardinals of the Universal Inquisition, as we have just seen, decreed that the actual form and state of the universe is false and contrary to the Holy Scriptures. Can it not now be said, then, on the word of these competent doctors, that since what then was thought to be false is proven true, what then was deemed to be true is proven false, absurd, and philosophically erroneous, because it is expressly contrary to the facts? What is the modern mind to make of the pious belief confirmed as dogma 2 decades ago and reconfirmed in the Credo of Pope Paul VI, June 30, 1968, of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary? Is one to imagine a human body rising from this earth to pass beyond the bounds of our solar system, beyond the bounds then of the Milky Way, beyond the bounds next of our supergalaxy, and beyond the bounds even of what may lie beyond that? If so, then please, at what velocity is this body moving? For it must still be in flight. Having been launched less than 2 millenniums ago, even if traveling at the speed of light, which for a physical body is impossible, both the body of our Lord Jesus Christ, which began its own ascent some 15 years earlier, and that of His most glorious Virgin Mother Mary, would now be only some 2,000 light-years away, not yet beyond the horizon of the Milky Way. The image is ridiculous. We have to ask, therefore, whether any meaning, spiritual or otherwise, can possibly inhere in such a figure today. Originally conceived when it could have been thought literally that Joshua stopped the sun and that God in his heaven dwelt but a short way beyond the orbit of Saturn, a figure of this kind imposes on the modern mind a feat of interpretation far more sophisticated than anything demanded of the faithful in the Middle Ages. And it is obvious, furthermore, that this problem touches not only Catholic Christianity, but every one of the great traditions. For it cannot be denied that even though some may now be symbolically reinterpreted by those who wish to retain them, pouring very new wine into very old bottles, in the days when they were brought into being as images of the highest truth, they were always literally as well as symbolically understood, or, to use the terms of St. Augustine, corporeally as well as spiritually. Moreover, they always guaranteed to their believers a spiritual superiority over the other peoples of the earth, and we may well ask whether in our world today there is still room for such dangerous nonsense. Let us ask, therefore, what can the value or meaning be of a mythological notion which, in the light of modern science, must be said to be erroneous, philosophically false, absurd, or even formally insane? The first answer suggested will no doubt be the one that, in the course of the past century, has been offered many times by our leading thinkers. The value, namely, is to be studied rather as a function of psychology and sociology than as a refuted system of positivistic science, rather in terms of certain effects worked by the symbols on the character of the individual and the structure of society than in terms of their obvious incongruity as an image of the cosmos. Their value, in other words, is not that of science, but that of art. And just as art may be studied psychologically as symbolic or symptomatic of the strains and structures of the psyche, so may the archetypes of myth, fairy tale, archaic philosophy, cosmology, and metaphysics. This is the point of view that Professor Rudolf Carnap has presented in the chapter The Rejection of Metaphysics in his University of London lectures, Philosophy and Logical Syntax, which were published in 1935. There he states that metaphysical propositions are neither true nor false, but expressive. They are like music, or like lyric poems, or like laughter. And yet, he states, they pretend to be representative. They pretend to have theoretical value, and therewith not only is the reader or hearer deceived, but the metaphysician also. The metaphysician believes, wrote Dr. Carnap, that in his metaphysical treatise he has asserted something, and he is led by this into argument and polemics against the propositions of some other metaphysician. A poet, however, does not assert that the verses of another are wrong or erroneous. He usually contents himself with calling them bad. C.G. Jung, in many passages, has drawn a distinction between the terms sign and symbol as he employs them. The first, the sign, is a reference to some concept or object, definitely known. The second, the symbol, is the best possible figure by which allusion may be made to something relatively unknown. The symbol does not aim at being a reproduction, nor can its meaning be more adequately or lucidly rendered in other terms. Indeed, when a symbol is allegorically translated and the unknown factor in its reference rejected, it is dead. I believe we may say that, in general, the symbols of science and of symbolic logic are, in this sense, signs, and the figures of art, in this sense, symbols. In Indian philosophy, two terms occur that are the counterparts of sign and symbol as here interpreted. The first, pratyaksha, from prati, meaning near to, over against, plus aksha, the eye, over against or apparent to the eye, refers to the sensible, obvious, evident, immediate field perceptible to the senses. This field described is that of waking consciousness. Here, subject and object are separate from each other, and the phenomena observed are of gross matter, while the logic of the relationship of things and concepts to each other can be expressed largely in Euclidean or Aristotelian terms. A is not not A. Two objects cannot occupy the same place at the same time. In modern physics, of course, those obvious rules have begun to blur at the edges, so that scientific and logical formulae now exhibit some of the qualities of art. But the referenda of these modern formulae are invisible to the eye, and are composed, furthermore, not of gross matter, but of what the Indians call subtle matter. Hence, they would seem to pertain actually to the field of the second term. This second term, which would be a counterpart of Jung's symbolic, is paroksha, again from aksha, meaning eye, but now with the prefix paras, beyond, far away, higher than, so that the meaning is beyond the reach of the eye. For the references of a paroksha vocabulary are not immediately perceptible to waking consciousness. They are, rather, like Platonic ideas, purely intelligible, spiritual, or esoteric. They are said to be adidevata, divine or angelic, but they are perceived by the saints and sages in vision, and so are said to pertain to the field of dreaming. The phantasmagorias of dream and vision are of subtle matter. Extremely fluent and mercurial, they are not illuminated like gross objects from without, but are self-luminous. Moreover, their logic is not that of Aristotle. In dreams, we all know, the subject and object are not separate from each other, though they seem so to the dreamer, but identical, and two or more objects, furthermore, not only can, but always do, occupy the same place at the same time. The images, that is to say, are polysynthetic and polysemantic, and, I might add, in both aspects inexhaustible when analyzed from the standpoint of waking consciousness. The law of this sphere is well epitomized in Levi Bruhl's term participation mystique, which is frequently cited by Jung. In the Orient, the realms of the gods and demons, the heavens, purgatories, and hells, are assigned to this sphere and are of subtle matter. They are the macrocosmic counterpart of the microcosmic images of dream. But since we do not encounter on this level the sort of clear distinction between A and not A that is proper to the field of waking consciousness, micro and macrocosm on this level are not as different as they seem, and all the gods, therefore, all the powers of heaven and hell, are within us. The references of religious art in the Orient, in contrast to the West, are, almost always, not to the phenomenology of waking consciousness, but to that of dream. Hence the findings of modern science do not as greatly trouble Hinduism and Buddhism as they trouble Christianity and Judaism, where all the symbols have been taught and read as signs. Nevertheless, even in the Orient there is thought to be a real and necessary correspondence between the phenomenology of dream consciousness and that of waking. Micro and macrocosm, which in dream may be experienced as identical, when we are awake are to be recognized as anurupam, in the image of each other. In fact, I am sure that it can be said without exception that wherever a system of mythological symbols is alive and fully operative, it unites in a single cohesive order all phenomena, both of the corporeal, directly obvious pratyaksha, sphere of waking consciousness, and of the spiritual, metaphysical, occult, purely intelligible, paroksha, sphere of dream. Hence, an imprecise fusion of sign and symbol, fact and fancy, is characteristic of the entire range and history of the archaic cultures, and we may well say, consequently, that one of the chief philosophical effects of the crisis represented by my crucial date, 1492, was that of the fracturing of this vague mythological order, the drawing of a distinct dividing plane between the world of dream consciousness and that of waking, together with a radical shift of the commitment of the waking intellect from the logic of the former to that of the latter. This we term the scientific revolution, which is still in progress, and it is amounting indeed to the creation of a new world, or, to use a mythological image, to a separation of heaven and earth. Mythological cosmologies, it now must be recognized, do not correspond to the world of gross facts, but are functions of dream and vision, and therefore the meanings, if any, inherent in or implied by the propositions of theology and metaphysics are not to be sought at the other end of either the microscope or the telescope. They are not verifiable through any science of physical research, but belong rather to the science of the psyche. And here, as we know, considerable progress has already been made toward a reconstruction of our understanding of their terms. Indeed, for some, this ancient lore, now interpreted psychologically instead of cosmologically, has actually seemed to restore the old religions to their former place, both in the center and around the bounding horizon of the sphere of the human spirit, as representing not merely a passing phase in the history of the evolution of consciousness, but a permanent spiritual legacy, symbolic of the very structure of the psyche. The assumption of the Virgin and the ascension of her divine Son, who was and is forever both true God and true man, may now be sensitively glosed in a manner that would have brought us all to the stake a mere 3 centuries ago. And on the groundswell of this fortunate heresy, O Felix Culpa, The ship of the city of God is lifted off the rocks and carried powerfully on its way. But now let us ask very calmly, objectively, and honestly, is it true that these discredited cosmological dogmas, which are now returning to us as psychological symbols, is it true that all these archaic propositions which have been disqualified from top to bottom as representations of the macrocosm can now be safely restored to favor as a universal revelation of the microcosm? Are these forms, these sacred mandalas, icons, and yantras, these gods who sit about the world, hand down their moral edicts, or come down to man as incarnations and fly back to heaven again, are these actually the symbolic guardians of some kind of natural or supernatural law, qualifying the meaning and destiny of man, bounding, binding, and yet guiding him to his proper end? Do they have meaning, that is to say, as microcosmic universals, and hence, perhaps finally, in some mysterious manner, as macrocosmic universals after all? Or must we judge them, rather, as functions merely of a certain phase or form of human culture, not of universal psychological validity, but sociologically determined? In the latter event, like the carapace of a crayfish or cocoon of a butterfly that has been cracked, sloughed off, and left behind, they too have been cracked, for they were certainly cracked in 1492, and should now be left behind. The mythic forms of archaic civilization. One of the most interesting and important of the many critical developments that have taken place in the field of archaeological research in recent decades has been that of the steady progress of excavations in the Near East, which have now begun to bring into clear focus the chief centers of origin and the main paths of diffusion of the earliest Neolithic culture forms. To present very briefly the main result of this work pertinent to our present theme, let me commence by saying that the arts of grain agriculture and stock breeding, which are the basic forms of economy on which all of the high cultures of the world are based, now appear to have been developed in the Near East, commencing about 9000 BC, and to have spread eastward and westward from this center in a broad band, displacing the earlier, much more precariously supported hunting and food collecting cultures, until both the Pacific coast of Asia and the Atlantic coasts of Europe and Africa were reached about 3500 BC. Meanwhile, in the nuclear zone from which this diffusion had originated, a further development was accomplished, and both the mythological and the technological effects of this continuing development were subsequently diffused along the ways already blazed, until, again, the coasts were attained. That is to say, the transformation of society from a food-collecting, hunting, and root-gathering structure to an agrarian, stock-breeding, food-producing one took place specifically and uniquely in a certain definite region of the globe, at a certain definite time. And the development from this center of all the basic arts and myths of the agriculturally based archaic civilizations can be described in four great stages, briefly, as follows. A. The Proto-Neolithic, from circa 9000 BC. Stage 1, which we may term the Proto-Neolithic, is represented by an assemblage of artifacts discovered in the middle 20s by Dr. Dorothy Garrod at the so-called Mount Carmel Caves in Palestine. Similar artifacts have since been found as far south as to Helwan in Egypt, as far north as to Beirut and Yabrud, and as far east as to the Kurdish hills of Iraq. The industry is known to archaeology as the Natufian and has been variously assigned by differing scholars to dates as far apart as circa 9000 and circa 4500 BC. What the evidence suggests is a congeries of hunting tribes not yet dwelling in fixed villages, yet supplementing their food supply with some variety of grain-like grass. For sickle blades of stone have been found among the remains, and these suggest a harvest. Many bones of the pig, goat, sheep, ox, and an equid of some sort let us know furthermore that even if the Natufians were not yet domesticating, they were nevertheless slaughtering the same beasts that would later constitute the basic barnyard stock of all the higher cultures. Their style of life then was transitional, and let us mark the date. Mankind had inhabited this planet already for nearly 2 million years, yet here, not 12,000 years ago, is the first hint even of the beginnings of a turn to agriculture. B. The Basal Neolithic, from circa 7500 to 4500 BC. Stage 2 in the development of village farming in the Near East, which I have termed in the Masks of God the Basal Neolithic, and there dated circa 5500 to 4500 BC, has been so greatly expanded by the archaeology of the last 10 years that its dates must now be assigned to circa 7500 to 4500 BC, and within this span as many as 3 distinct sub-stages have been identified. Substage 1. A-Ceramic Neolithic, from circa 7500 BC. The earliest of these substages, the pre-pottery or A-ceramic Neolithic, was first disclosed and registered by Dr. Kathleen Kenyon in the lowest strata of the ancient mound of Jericho in Palestine, and Dr. James Millart in southern Turkey on the Anatolian Plain has since discovered an impressive series of sites of equivalent age. According to Dr. Kenyon, the earliest settlers at the Great Spring of Jericho were Natufians who built there a sanctuary of some kind that was subsequently burned down, leaving a charcoal deposit that has been dated by the carbon-14 method as 7800 BC plus or minus 210 years. The fragile shelters of these proto-Neolithic hunters gave place presently to houses built of plano-convex bricks, bricks with a flat base and curved top. The round or curvilinear forms of the little buildings imitating the earlier primitive huts. In time, this settlement, known as pre-pottery Neolithic A Jericho, was protected by a town wall of stone some 12 feet high and 6 feet 6 inches wide, with an associated stone watchtower rising to a height of at least 30 feet, suggesting that somewhere on the horizon there were enemies. It looks, Dr. Kenyon writes, as though there were two lines of development. One lower Natufian group settled down at Jericho, and it is surely to be presumed that other groups established settlements in comparable positions. But the cousins of the settled groups, living mainly in the hills in areas less favorable for agriculture, continued in a Mesolithic way of life, still living as hunters and food gatherers. The caves and shelters in which they lived have produced the implements which have been classified as Middle and Upper Natufian. And this, then, accounts for the great spread of differing dates for the Natufians suggested by earlier scholars. Somewhere about 7000 BC, this earliest settlement at Jericho was deserted and its site appropriated by a people of another culture, building houses of a different type, to which the name pre-pottery Neolithic B Jericho has been assigned. And these may have been the main enemies foreseen. Their buildings were of another, more highly evolved type. The newcomers arrived, Dr. Kenyon states, with this architecture fully developed. The houses were not circular, but rectangular, built of bricks of another shape and with several rooms having hard lime plaster floors, reddish or cream-colored and finished with a high burnish. The same kind of floors and rectangular dwellings have now been found in the Anatolian sites of Hajilar and Çatalhöyük, where they are of an earlier date than at Jericho, and not only the architecture but the evidences of religion too provide, as the excavator James Millart has pointed out, an unmistakable link between the pre-pottery levels at Hajilar, where he dates between circa 7000 and circa 6000 BC, and the pre-pottery B phase of Jericho, which he places at circa 6500 and 5500 BC. The principal shared religious features of Jericho and the Anatolian sites was an unmistakable skull cult. In the pre-pottery levels at Hajilar, human skulls propped up with stones on the floors of many houses and at the corners of the hearths indicate, according to Dr. Millart, that the inhabitants practiced an ancestor cult, preserving the heads to protect the homes. And in pre-pottery B Jericho, not only were skulls set up in the same way, but a number were found that had been lightly covered with plaster shaped to the likeness of human features, the eyes being of inset shells. So much, then, for the first substage of the Basal Neolithic. Substage 2, Ceramic Neolithic, from circa 6500 BC. The second substage appeared at Çatalhöyük abruptly at an astonishingly early date, and has been termed the pottery or ceramic Neolithic. At Çatalhöyük, states Dr. Millard, we can actually study the transition from an aceramic Neolithic with baskets and wooden vessels to a ceramic Neolithic with the first pottery. The deeper levels of this large and luxurious town site have not yet been investigated systematically, but a probe to level 13 has revealed the presence of pottery already at that depth, roughly 6500 BC, and with the pottery there has come to view an astonishing display of religious imagery in the wall paintings, mother goddess statuettes, bucrania, etc., of some 40 or more richly decorated shrines, which have advanced by some 2,000 years our knowledge of the backgrounds of the great mother goddess myths and cults of the ancient world. A figurine that was found at level 2, circa 5800 BC, in a grain bin, shows the goddess supported by leopards and giving birth to a child, whereas in a shrine at level 6, circa 5950 BC, she is shown giving birth to a bull. It is recalled that Osiris, Tammuz, Dionysus, and many other great divinities, symbolic of a resurrection beyond death, were in later centuries identified with the moon bull, who was both the child and the consort of the cosmic goddess. The pharaoh identified in death with Osiris was called, for example, the bull of his own mother. Taken back to the universal mother in death, he became, as it were, the seed of his own rebirth. Like the moon that dies each month into the sun to become in 3 days reborn. The male, declares Millart, discussing his finds at Çatalhöyük, appears either as husband or as son, and indeed again from level 6, there is an interesting dual figure showing the goddess back to back with herself, in one character embraced by an adult male, and in the other holding a child. And then there are the three walls, west, north, and east, of the so-called second vulture shrine of level 7, circa 6200 BC. Of the greatest interest here, in light of what we have learned of the pre-pottery skull cult, are the four human skulls ceremonially disposed, one beneath the mighty bucranium of the west wall, two on the northeast corner platform beneath a stylized female breast, and one more beneath an arrangement of three ram's heads, a bucranium, and row of six stylized female breasts. The entire north wall is decorated with paintings of vultures attacking headless human bodies, while on the southernmost panel of the long east wall, there is what Dr. Mellart describes as a large ram's head with actual horns and painted with a bold meander pattern, beneath a bold clay horn from which a single breast protrudes. Out of the open breast springs the lower jaw of a gigantic boar. Nor is this the only shrine at this site where the lower jaws of boars are contained within the models of the female breast. Fox and weasel skulls have been used in this way as well. And there is a shrine on level 6 where the heads of two griffin vultures are sealed within a pair of breasts, with the beaks protruding from the open red-painted nipples. The idea suggested would seem to be of a mother who eats back the lives she has nourished, the mother to whom the dead are returned for rebirth. Contrasting symbols of life and death, states Dr. Millart, are a constant feature of Çatalhöyük. Substage 3. Early Chalcolithic from circa 5500 BC. The third and final substage, then, of the Basal Neolithic, as it has been brought to light from the early mounds of the Anatolian Plain, is termed, for this area, the Early Chalcolithic, since there have been found among the remains a few artifacts of metal. The beginnings of metallurgy, specifically the smelting and working of copper and lead into beads, tubes, and other trinkets, are already evident at Çatalhöyük as early as level 9, circa 6300 BC, which is the earliest date for the knowledge of metals yet registered anywhere on Earth. However, it is not until nearly a millennium later, circa 5500 BC, that metal tools become numerous enough, though still relatively unimportant, to warrant the recognition of a copper stone, chalcolithic phase of this basal Neolithic development. Dr. Millart has been able to mark in detail a gradual progression from ceramic Neolithic to early chalcolithic, particularly well at Hajalar, where, as he declares, the first copper implements appear, and with them painted pottery in force. The truly superb pottery of this period developed, he continues, out of the late Neolithic, some still in monochrome, but most of it gaily painted in red or cream. Geometric patterns, many derived from textiles or woven mats, prevailed in the early phases of the period. Later, circa 5200 to 5000 BC, the patterns took on bold curves, the so-called fantastic style. And a somewhat surprising observation touching the art styles of the Neolithic female figurines can also be made at this point. For whereas those of the earlier ceramic Neolithic had been naturalistic and lifelike, giving us, as Mellart declares, for the first time in Near Eastern prehistory a reliable picture of what late Neolithic woman looked like, those of this early Chalcolithic period, circa 5500 to 4500 BC, are conventionalized fertility symbols. And as time goes on, the figurines become more and more stylized and unlifelike. C. The High Neolithic, circa 4500 to 3500 BC, Middle and Late Chalcolithic. And so we are brought to the next great stage in the evolution of civilization, which I have termed in The Masks of God the High Neolithic, 4500 to 3500 BC, that of the beautiful, geometrically conceived, painted ceramic wares of Halaf, Samarra, and Obeid, which had also been called the Middle and Late Chalcolithic. Dr. Kenyon explains, "The difficulty in deciding where to place the transition from the Neolithic to the Chalcolithic is reflected in the existing confusion in nomenclature. Sometimes the one and sometimes the other name is given to allied groups. The transition is in fact a gradual one. The dawn of the new era is not marked by the sudden appearance of copper implements on a site, but by the gradual breakdown of isolation and the resultant spreading of ideas and cultures over a considerable area. In Palestine, in fact, as far as our evidence goes, metal seems to have played a relatively small part among the materials employed until quite a late date, about the end of the third millennium. But in spite of this, the change in outlook is reflected in the gradual growth of widespread cultures and the eventual amalgamation of isolated groups into a cultural whole. In the northern part of the Fertile Crescent, this stage is marked by the appearance of a widespread culture called Halafian, after Tel Halaf in northern Iraq, where it was first found. Site after site from Mesopotamia across to the Mediterranean coast has shown that after the stage of the Neolithic villages with all their diverse ways of life, a remarkably similar economy appears with, as a characteristic feature, a type of pottery with geometric decoration in red on a light background. This is usually dated to the late 5th millennium. The arts of carpentry and housebuilding, weaving, ceramic crafts, and even metallurgy have been added to the sum of human skills. An imposing mythology to be echoed through all subsequent high traditions to the present has been articulated in a well-developed constellation of iconographic arts, which, in the rendition of certain themes, were already losing immediacy and devolving into abstractions. Settled village life, based on a barnyard economy, is now, throughout the nuclear Near East, a firmly established pattern, the grains being chiefly wheat and barley, and the animals, the pig, goat, sheep, and ox, the dog having already joined the human family as early, perhaps, as about 15,000 BC, as an aid and companion of hunters in the late Paleolithic. And society, apparently, has already become differentiated with specialist craftsmen producing articles of luxury, a special priestly order of some kind, and possibly also governing authorities, as Dr. Kenyon has observed, already at the level of pre-pottery A. Jericho. The evidence that there was an efficient communal organization is to be seen in the great defensive system, the Great Wall and Tower of Stone. Then suddenly, quite suddenly, in the highly styled painted ceramic wares of the High Neolithic, Middle and Late Chalcolithic towns, circa 4500 BC, a totally new concept of art becomes apparent in the very beautiful, strictly balanced, circular organizations of abstract aesthetic forms applied to the decoration of vessels of all kinds. In the earlier Paleolithic art of the great caves of southern France and northern Spain, which are now being dated circa 30,000 to circa 9,000 BC, we do not find evidence of a concept of geometrical organization. Professor André Leroy Gourhan has recently demonstrated that the positioning of the figures engraved and painted on the walls of the caves was not at all haphazard, but strictly ordered by a mythology in which the form of the cave itself participated. The cavern, he states, is truly, as it were, an organized world, and he compares the organization to that of a cathedral. What images are normally at the entrance? What halfway down the nave? What in the apse, the Lady Chapel? What and where is the high altar, etc.? The organization, that is to say, is mythological and three-dimensional, architectural, as it were, and the figures are, for the most part, beautifully alive. We do not find anywhere in this cave art aesthetically conceived signs and abstractions, symmetrically arranged in a closed, geometrically organized, two-dimensional aesthetic field. No mandalas or anything of the kind. In fact, the painted or incised surfaces of the cave walls are so little regarded as fields of aesthetic interest in themselves that the animals frequently overlap each other in great tangles. Nor do we find anything like an aesthetic organization of the field in the works surviving to us from the later terminal stages of the Paleolithic, where many of the petroglyphs have lost the earlier impressionistic beauty and precision, and some have even deteriorated into mere geometric scrawls or abstractions. On certain flat-painted pebbles that have been found in what apparently were religious sanctuaries, geometrical symbols appear. The cross, the circle with a dot in the center, a line with a dot on either side, stripes, meanders, and something resembling the letter E. Yet we do not find, even in this late stage of the hunting period, anything that could be termed a geometrical organization, anything suggesting the concept of a definitely circumscribed field in which a number of disparate elements are united and fused into one aesthetic whole by a rhythm of beauty. Whereas suddenly, in the period of the High Neolithic towns, there breaks into view from a number of centers an elegant display of the most gracefully and tastefully organized mandalas, in the painted ceramic wares of the so-called Halaf and Samara styles. And so now, returning to the argument of the first part of this essay, we have to ask ourselves whether it can be properly claimed that these geometrical forms, which have become the commonplaces of our modern psychological discussion of archetypal symbols, actually do represent basal structures of the human psyche, or may not rather be functioned only of a certain type or phase of social development incidental to the history of a limited portion of the race. The question is one of considerable moment, for on it depends our whole interpretation of the so-called spiritual, divine, esoteric, or mystical, paroksha references of our psychological vocabulary. Yet, as far as I know, it has not been systematically studied. What I should like to propose, therefore, is a preliminary hypothesis, an idea that occurred to me some years ago during the course of a comparative study of the myths and art of certain living hunting races with those of the archaic Near East. The Neolithic-Paleolithic contrast. To begin with, then, let me call attention to the fact that among hunting peoples, the young male adult, or even the normal youngster of 10 or 12, is a more or less competent master of the entire technological inheritance of his culture. The late Dr. Geza Roheim remarked on this with reference to the hunting peoples of Australia. In one of his last publications, he wrote, "I shall never forget the Pijintara children who, at the age of 8 or 10, went roaming about the desert and were practically self-supporting. A boy with his keen eyes and spear can catch what he needs in small fry and keep going from morning until evening. Even an adult male cannot do very much more. The outstanding characteristic of primitive economics is the absence of a true differentiation of labor. An incipient or rudimentary division of labor may exist along sexual or age lines, and there may be some incipient and part-time specialization in matters of ritual and magic. But true specialization is lacking. This means that every individual is technically a master of the whole culture, or, where certain modest qualifications are necessary, of almost the whole culture. In other words, each individual is really self-reliant and grown up. We, however, do not grow up as simply as that. If the testimony of anthropology indicates anything, it shows that primitive man is free, untrammeled, and truly self-reliant in comparison with medieval or modern man. It was this remark of Dr. Roheim's that seemed to me to offer the clue to the interpretation of the sudden appearance of the mandala and of other geometrical organizations of enclosed fields after the passing of the hunting age and with the development of the agricultural. For, whereas in the camps of the hunters the community was constituted of a group of practically equivalent individuals, each in adequate control of the whole inheritance, in the larger, more greatly differentiated communities that developed when agriculture and stock breeding had made for a settled, more richly articulated social structure, adulthood consisted in acquiring first a certain special art or skill, and then the ability to support or sustain the resultant tension, a psychological and sociological tension between oneself as merely a fraction of a larger whole, and others of totally different training, powers, and ideals who constituted the other necessary organs of the body social. The problem of existing as a mere fraction instead of as a whole imposes certain stresses on the psyche, which no primitive hunter ever had to endure, and consequently the symbols giving structure and support to the development of the primitive hunter's psychological balance were radically different from those that arose in the settled villages, in the Basal and High Neolithic, and which have been inherited from that age and continued into the present by all the high civilizations of the world. Furthermore, by far the greatest number of the so-called primitive peoples today are not actually primitive in their culture, but regressed. Regressed Neolithic, regressed Bronze, or even regressed Iron Age culture provinces. For example, even the pygmoid Negritos of the Andaman Islands, who are certainly among the most primitive peoples now living on Earth, cannot be studied simply as primitives. For there is a good deal of evidence not only in their kitchen middens, which have been piling up for thousands of years, but also in their myths and folkways, of important cultural influences which arrived from the Southeast Asian mainland, beginning perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, and which brought to them not only pottery and the pig, but also a new method of cooking and even the art of smoking pipes. They have, besides, an extremely beautiful type of bow, which is not by any means a primitive weapon, but one that appears only as late as the Mesolithic, that is to say, in the culture period just preceding that of the dawn of the arts of food cultivation. Now, it should certainly not be necessary to point out that one cannot safely draw conclusions concerning the typology and archetypology of the human psyche in general from any body of evidence, no matter how abundant, that has been gathered almost exclusively from one province, even though a very great one. The province, namely, of the range and influence of the food-producing settled villages, towns, and cities of the comparatively brief Neolithic and post-Neolithic era of the human race. When it is recalled, as already remarked, that the earliest evidences of man in this world date from the neighborhood of 2 million years ago, and that the period during which he has been an agriculturalist embraces no more than some 10,000, a segment, that is to say, of less than one-half of 1% of the known arc, and when it is considered further that this physical body of ours, of which our psyche is a function, evolved under the conditions not of agriculture but of the hunt, then perhaps it may be asked whether this whole history and mythology of the earth-rooted, walled town or village with its temple tower in the center, lifting the goddess Earth to her divine connubium with the All-Father of the overarching fertilizing sky, is not perhaps only a highly specialized formula, not normal to the psyche of the species, but rather an effect of the tensions, fears, and expectations generated in a society based on an agricultural economy. And we may ask also, then, whether today, when that economy is giving way to one based on industry, and the cosmological image commensurate with an agricultural horizon has been shattered for us forever, whether today, in this next great age of transformation, the images generated in that earlier period of crisis still are of use, and if so, for whom and why? It was during the Basal Neolithic Substage 2 in the phase now known as Ceramic Neolithic, identified at Çatalhöyük circa 6500 BC, that the earliest of those Neolithic mother goddess figurines appear that mark throughout the world the dawn of an order of myths and rites relative specifically to the generative and nourishing female powers of the tilled earth. But there is also a much earlier series of naked figurines, of the type of the Paleolithic Venus of Willendorf, from the period of the art of the hunters of the great French and Spanish caves. And there is an extremely perplexing question connected with the history of that series, for it has been observed that although their cult seems to have extended all the way from the Pyrenees to Lake Baikal in Siberia, the period of their florescence was comparatively brief. As the art of painting developed and the beautiful animal forms took possession of the walls of the great caves, the carving of the figurines was discontinued. Furthermore, whenever human forms do appear among the painted animals, they are of masculine shamans, the representation of the human female having practically ceased. And so we have to understand that there were two quite distinct orders of culture in which female figurines played a preponderant role in the symbolism of magic and religion, and that these now appear to have been separated by a span of at least 10,000 years. We find certain symbols in the centers of the High Neolithic mandalas, and these have remained characteristic of such organizations to the very present. In the Samara ware, for example, we discover the earliest known association of the swastika with the mandala. In fact, there is only one earlier known occurrence of the swastika anywhere, and that is on the wings of a flying bird, carved of mammoth ivory, found in a late Paleolithic site not far from Kiev. Frequently in the Samara ware, the swastika appears in the sinister form, with the angled arms pointing leftward, and this may or may not be a significant fact. We also find the Maltese cross in the centers of these early mandalas, occasionally modified in such a way as to suggest stylized animal forms, as though the beasts were emerging from the whirling arms. In several examples, the stylized forms of women appear, with their feet or heads coming together in the middle of the mandala to constellate a star. Such mandalas are usually fourfold in design, but occasionally fivefold, sixfold, or eightfold. Or again, the forms of four gazelles may circumambulate a tree. Some of the designs show lovely wading birds catching a fish. The archaeological site after which this superb series of decorated vessels has been named, Samara, is located in Iraq on the river Tigris, some 20 miles above Baghdad, and the area over which the ware has been diffused extends northward to Nineveh, southward to the head of the Persian Gulf, and eastward across Iran as far as to the border of Afghanistan. The Halaf ware, on the other hand, is scattered through an area northwestward of this, with its chief center in northern Syria, just south of the so-called Taurus or Bull Mountains of Anatolia, neighboring Çatalhöyük and Hajilar, whence the river Euphrates and its tributaries descend from the foothills to the plain. And what is most remarkable is the prominence in this beautifully decorated ware of the bull's head, the bucranium, as at Çatalhöyük, viewed from before and with great curving horns. The form is depicted both naturalistically and in various stylized, very graceful designs. Another prominent device in this series is the double axe, which in later Cretan art is the sign and weapon of the goddess. Once again, we find the Maltese cross, as in Samara, but significantly, perhaps, no swastika, nor those graceful gazelle designs. Furthermore, in association with the female statuettes, which are numerous in this context, we find clay figures of the dove, as well as of the pig, cow, humped ox, sheep, and goat. One charming pottery fragment represents the goddess standing between two goats rampant, that on her left, a male, the other, a female, giving suck to a young kid. And all these symbols are associated in this Halafian culture complex with the so-called beehive tomb. Now this, precisely, is the complex that not only appeared a millennium later in Crete, but also was carried from there by sea, through the gates of Hercules, north to the British Isles and south to the Gold Coast, Nigeria, and the Congo. It is, in fact, the basic complex also of the Mycenaean culture from which the Greeks, and therewith ourselves, derived so many symbols. And when the cult of the dead and resurrected moon god was carried from Syria to the Nile Delta in the 4th or 3rd millennium BC, these symbols went with it. Indeed, I believe that we may claim with a very high degree of certainty that in this Halafian symbology of the bull and the goddess, the dove and the double axe, we have at once a continuation of the mythological tradition already announced 2,000 years before in the chapels of Çatal Huyuk, and a halfway station of that continuing tradition toward its culmination in the great historical religions of Ishtar and Tammuz, Isis and Osiris, Venus and Adonis, Mary and Jesus. From the Taurus Mountains, the mountains of the bull god who must already have been identified with the horned moon which dies and is resurrected, the cult was diffused with the art of cattle breeding itself, practically to the ends of the earth, and we celebrate the mystery of that mythological death and resurrection to this day as a promise of our own eternity. The imminence, then, of eternity in the passages of time would be the meaning or reference of this archaic mystery play. But what is eternity and what time? And why in the image of the bull or of the moon? D. The Hieratic City-State, circa 3500 to 2500 BC. Stage 4 in the development of the Near East of the agriculturally based civilization from which all the high cultures of the world have been derived took place about 3500 BC, half a millennium earlier, circa 4000 BC, the date assigned in the book of Genesis to the creation of the world. A number of the Neolithic villages had begun to assume the size and function of market towns, and there had been, furthermore, an expansion of the Chalcolithic culture area southward into the mud flats of riverine Mesopotamia. That was the period in which the really great and still mysterious race of the Sumerians first appeared on the scene to establish in the torrid Tigris and Euphrates Delta flats those sites that were to become, by circa 3500 BC, the kingly cities of Ur, Kish, Lagash, Eridu, Sippar, Shurupak, Nippur, and Erek. The only natural resources in that land were mud and reeds. Wood and stone had to be imported from the north. But the mud was fertile, and the fertility was annually refreshed. Furthermore, the mud could be fashioned into sun-dried bricks that could be used for the construction of temples, which now appear for the first time in the history of the world, their form being of the ziggurat in its earliest stage, a little height, artificially constructed, supporting a chapel for the ritual of the world-generating union of the earth goddess with a god of the sky. And if we may judge from the evidence of the following centuries, the queen or princess of each city was in these earliest days identified with the goddess, and the king, her spouse, with the god. During the course of the 4th millennium BC, the temples in these riverine towns increased in size and importance, becoming the economic as well as the religious and political centers of the growing communities. And then, at a date that can now be almost precisely fixed at 3200 BC, the period of the archaeological stratum known as Uruk B, there appeared in this little Sumerian mud garden, as though the flowers of its tiny cities were suddenly bursting into bloom, the whole cultural syndrome that has, ever since, constituted the ground base of the high civilizations of the world. This, the fourth and culminating stage of the development that I am here tracing, we may term that of the hieratic city-state. But let us pause to repeat. We have named the proto-Neolithic period of the Natufians, circa 9000 BC, where the first signs of an incipient grain agriculture appear, the basal Neolithic of the Aceramic, Ceramic, and early Chalcolithic villages, circa 7500 to 4500 BC, when the mother goddess of an already well-established peasantry makes her first dramatic appearance, then the High Neolithic, Middle and Late Chalcolithic of the Halaf and Samara painted wares, circa 4500 BC, when the abstract concept of a geometrically organized aesthetic field first appears and the Late Neolithic market towns begin to elevate temple towers. And now, finally, we have come to an epical date circa 3200 BC when, suddenly, at precisely that geographical point where the rivers Tigris and Euphrates reach the Persian Gulf, the wonderful culture flower comes to blossom of the hieratic city-state. The whole city now, not simply the temple area, is conceived as an imitation on earth of the celestial order, a sociological middle cosmos or mesocosm between the macrocosm of the universe and the microcosm of the individual, making visible their essential form, with the king in the center.